Chapter 76. A solo and a duet. The wind was blowing so hard, when the visitor came out at the shop door into the darkness and dirt of Limehouse Hole, that it almost blew him in again. Doors were slamming violently, lamps were flickering or blown out, signs were rocking in their frames, the water of the kennels, wind dispersed, flew about in drops like rain. Indifferent to the weather, and even preferring it to better weather for its clearance of the streets, the man looked about him with a scrutinizing glance. "Thus much I know," apostrophe he murmured. "I have never been here since that night, and never was here before that night, but thus much I recognize. I wonder which way did we take when we came out of that shop. We turned to the right as I have turned, but I can recall no more. Did we go by this alley? Or down that little lane?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, he tried both, but both confused him equally, and he came straying back to the same spot. "I remember there were poles pushed out of upper windows on which clothes were drying, and I remember a low public house, and the sound flowing down the narrow passage belonging to it of the scraping of a fiddle and the shuffling of feet. But here are all these things in the lane, and here are all these things in the alley. And I have nothing else in my mind but a wall, a dark doorway, a flight of stairs, and a room." Apostrophe, he tried a new direction, but made nothing of it. Walls, dark doorways, flights of stairs and rooms, were too abundant. And, like most people so puzzled, he again and again described a circle, and found himself at the point from which he had begun. "This is like what I have read in narratives of escape from prison," apostrophe said he, "where the little track of the fugitives, in the night always seems to take the shape of the great round world, on which they wander, as if it were a secret law." Apostrophe, here he ceased to be the oakum-headed, oakum-whiskered man on whom Miss Pleasant Riderhood had looked, and, allowing for his being still wrapped in a nautical overcoat, became as like that same lost wanted Mr. Julius Hanford, as never man was like another in this world. In the breast of the coat he stowed the bristling hair and whisker, in a moment, as the favoring wind went with him down a solitary place, that it had swept clear of passengers. Yet in that same moment he was the secretary also, Mr. Boffin's secretary. For John Rokesmith, too, was as like that same lost wanted Mr. Julius Hanford as never man was like another in this world. "I have no clue to the scene of my death," apostrophe said he. "Not that it matters now. But having risked discovery, by venturing here at all, I should have been glad to track some part of the way." Apostrophe, with which singular words he abandoned his search, came up out of Limehouse Hole, and took the way past Limehouse Church. At the great iron gate of the churchyard he stopped and looked in. He looked up at the high tower spectrally resisting the wind, and he looked round at the white tombstones, like enough to the dead in their winding sheets, and he counted the 9 tolls of the clock bell. "It is a sensation not experienced by many mortals," apostrophe said he, "to be looking into a churchyard on a wild windy night, and to feel that I no more hold a place among the living than these dead do, and even to know that I lie buried somewhere else, as they lie buried here. Nothing uses me to it. A spirit that was once a man could hardly feel stranger or lonelier, going unrecognized among mankind, than I feel. But this is the fanciful side of the situation. It has a real side, so difficult that, though I think of it every day, I never thoroughly think it out. Now, let me determine to think it out as I walk home. I know I evade it, as many men, perhaps most men, do evade thinking their way through their greatest perplexity. I will try to pin myself to mine. Don't evade it, John Harmon. Don't evade it. Think it out. When I came to England, attracted to the country with which I had none, but most miserable associations, by the accounts of my fine inheritance that found me abroad, I came back, shrinking from my father's money, shrinking from my father's memory, mistrustful of being forced on a mercenary wife, mistrustful of my father's intention in thrusting that marriage on me, mistrustful that I was already growing avaricious, mistrustful that I was slackening in gratitude to the two dear noble honest friends who had made the only sunlight in my childish life, or that of my Hrithrican sister. I came back, timid, divided in my mind, afraid of myself and everybody here, knowing of nothing but wretchedness that my father's wealth had ever brought about. Now, stop, and so far think it out, John Harmon. Is that so?
That is exactly so.
On board serving as third mate was George Radfoot. I knew nothing of him. His name first became known to me about a week before we sailed, through my being accosted by one of the ship agent's clerks as Mr. Radfoot. It was one day, when I had gone aboard to look to my preparations, and the clerk, coming behind me as I stood on deck, tapped me on the shoulder, and said, "Mr. Radfoot, look here," referring to some papers that he had in his hand. And my name first became known to Radfoot, through another clerk within a day or two, and while the ship was yet in port, coming up behind him, tapping him on the shoulder and beginning, "I beg your pardon, Mr. Harmon, I believe we were alike in bulk and stature but not otherwise, and that we were not strikingly alike, even in those respects, when we were together, and could be compared. However, a sociable word or two on these mistakes became an easy introduction between us, and the weather was hot, and he helped me to a cool cabin on deck alongside his own, and his first school had been at Brussels as mine had been, and he had learned French as I had learned it, and he had a little history of himself to relate, God only knows how much of it true, and how much of it false, that had its likeness to mine. I had been a seaman too. So we got to be confidential together, and the more easily yet, because he and everyone on board had known by general rumor what I was making the voyage to England for. By such degrees and means, he came to the knowledge of my uneasiness of mind, and of its setting at that time in the direction of desiring to see, and form some judgment of my allotted wife, before she could possibly know me for myself. Also to try Mrs. Boffin, and give her a glad surprise. So the plot was made out of our getting common sailors' dresses as he was able to guide me about London, and throwing ourselves in Bella Wilfer's neighborhood, and trying to put ourselves in her way, and doing whatever chance might favor on the spot, and seeing what came of it. If nothing came of it, I should be no worse off, and there would merely be a short delay in my presenting myself to Lightwood. I have all these facts right?
Yes.
They are all accurately right. His advantage in all this was, that for a time I was to be lost. It might be for a day or for 2 days, but I must be lost sight of on landing, or there would be recognition, anticipation, and failure. Therefore, I disembarked with my valise in my hand as Poderson the steward, and Mr. Jacob Kibble my fellow passenger afterwards remembered and waited for him in the dark by that very Limehouse church which is now behind me. As I had always shunned the port of London, I only knew the church through his pointing out its spire from on board. Perhaps I might recall, if it were any good to try, the way by which I went to it alone from the river. But how we two went from it to Riderhood's shop, I don't know any more than I know what turns we took, and doubles we made, after we left it. The way was purposely confused, no doubt. But let me go on thinking the facts out, and avoid confusing them with my speculations. Weatherby took me by a straight way or a crooked way, what is that to the purpose now?
Steady, John Harmon.
When we stopped at Riderhood's, and he asked that scoundrel a question or two, purporting to refer only to the lodging houses in which there was accommodation for us, had I the least suspicion of him?
None.
Certainly none until afterwards, when I held the clue. I think he must have got from Riderhood in a paper, the drug, or whatever it was, that afterwards stupefied me, but I am far from sure. All I felt safe in charging on him tonight was old companionship in villainy between them. Their undisguised intimacy, and the character I now know Riderhood to bear, made that not at all adventurous. But I am not clear about the drug. Thinking out the circumstances on which I found my suspicion, they are only two.
1. I remember his changing a small folded paper from one pocket to another after we came out, which he had not touched before. 2. I now know Riderhood to have been previously taken up for being concerned in the robbery of an unlucky seaman to whom some such poison had been given. It is my conviction that we cannot have gone a mile from that shop before we came to the wall, the dark doorway, the flight of stairs, and the room. The night was particularly dark, and it rained hard. As I think the circumstances back, I hear the rain splashing on the stone pavement of the passage. WHCH was not under cover. The room overlooked the river, or a dock, or a creek, and the tide was out. Being possessed of the time down to that point, I know by the hour that it must have been about low water. But while the coffee was getting ready, I drew back the curtain, a dark brown curtain, and, looking out, knew by the kind of reflection below, of the few neighboring lights, that they were reflected in tidal mud. He had carried under his arm a canvas bag, containing a suit of his clothes. I had no change of outer clothes with me, as I was to buy slops. "You are very wet, Mr. Harmon," I can hear him saying, "and I am quite dry under this good waterproof coat. Put on these clothes of mine. You may find on trying them that they will answer your purpose tomorrow, as well as the slops you mean to buy, or better. While you change, I'll hurry the hot coffee." When he came back, I had his clothes on, and there was a black man with him, wearing a linen jacket, like a steward, who put the smoking coffee on the table in a tray, and never looked at me. I am so far literal and exact. Literal and exact, I am certain. Now, I pass to sick and deranged impressions. They are so strong that I rely upon them. But there are spaces between them that I know nothing about, and they are not pervaded by any idea of time. I had drank some coffee, when to my sense of sighty began to swell immensely, and something urged me to rush at him. We had a struggle near the door. He got from me, through my not knowing where to strike, in the whirling round of the room, and the flashing of flames of fire between us. I dropped down. Lying helpless on the ground, I was turned over by a foot. I was dragged by the neck into a corner. I heard men speak together. I was turned over by other feet. I saw a figure like myself lying dressed in my clothes on a bed. What might have been, for anything I knew, a silence of days, weeks, months, years, was broken by a violent wrestling of men all over the room. The figure like myself was assailed, and my valise was in its hand. I was trodden upon and fallen over. I heard a noise of blows, and thought it was a woodcutter cutting down a tree. I could not have said that my name was John Harmon. I could not have thought it. I didn't know it, but when I heard the blows, I thought of the woodcutter and his axe, and had some dead idea that I was lying in a forest. This is still correct? Still correct, with the exception that I cannot possibly express it to myself without using the word one. But it was not one. There was no such thing as I, within my knowledge. It was only after a downward slide through something like a tube, and then a great noise and a sparkling and crackling as of fires, that the consciousness came upon me, "This is John Harmon drowning. John Harmon, struggle for your life. John Harmon, call on heaven and save yourself." I think I cried it out aloud in a great agony, and then a heavy, horrid, unintelligible something vanished, and it was I who was struggling there alone in the water. I was very weak and faint, frightfully oppressed with drowsiness, and driving fast with the tide. Looking over the black water, I saw the lights racing past me on the two banks of the river, as if they were eager to be gone, and leave me dying in the dark. The tide was running down, but I knew nothing of up or down then. When, guiding myself safely with heaven's assistance before the fierce set of the water, I at last caught at a boat moored, one of a tier of boats at a causeway, I was sucked under her, and came up, only just alive, on the other side. Was I long in the water? Long enough to be chilled to the heart, but I don't know how long.
Yet the cold was merciful, for it was the cold night air and the rain that restored me from a swoon on the stones of the causeway. They naturally supposed me to have toppled in, drunk, when I crept to the public house it belonged to, for I had no notion where I was, and could not articulate through the poison that had made me insensible having affected my speech, and I supposed the night to be the previous night, as it was still dark and raining. But I had lost 24 hours. I have checked the calculation often, and it must have been 2 nights that I lay recovering in that public house. Let me see. Yes. I am sure it was while I lay in that bed there that the thought entered my head of turning the danger I had passed through to the account of being for some time supposed to have disappeared mysteriously, and of proving Bella. The dread of our being forced on one another, and perpetuating the fate that seemed to have fallen on my father's riches, the fate that they should lead to nothing but evil, was strong upon the moral timidity that dates from my childhood with my poor sister. As to this hour, I cannot understand that side of the river where I recovered the shore being the opposite side to that on which I was ensnared. I shall never understand it now. Even at this moment, while I leave the river behind me, going home, I cannot conceive that it rolls between me and that spot, or that the sea is where it is. But this is not thinking it out, this is making a leap to the present time. I could not have done it, but for the fortune in the waterproof belt round my body. Not a great fortune, 40 and odd pounds for the inheritor of 100 and odd thousand. But it was enough. Without it, I must have disclosed myself. Without it, I could never have gone to that Exchequer coffee house, or taken Mrs. Wilfer's lodgings. Some 12 days I lived at that hotel, before the night when I saw the corpse of Ratfoot at the police station. The inexpressible mental horror that I labored under, as one of the consequences of the poison, makes the interval seem greatly longer, but I know it cannot have been longer. That suffering has gradually weakened and weakened since, and has only come upon me by starts, and I hope I am free from it now. But even now, I have sometimes to think, constrain myself, and stop before speaking, or I could not say the words I want to say. Again I ramble away from thinking it out to the end. It is not so far to the end that I need be tempted to break off. Now, on straight. I examined the newspapers every day for tidings that I was missing, but saw none. Going out that night to walk, for I kept retired while it was light, I found a crowd assembled round a placard posted at Whitehall. It described myself, John Harmon, as found dead and mutilated in the river under circumstances of strong suspicion. Described my dress, described the papers in my pockets, and stated where I was lying for recognition. In a wild and cautious way I hurried there, and there with the horror of the death I had escaped before my eyes in its most appalling shape, added to the inconceivable horror tormenting me at that time, when the poisonous stuff was strongest on me, I perceived that Ratfoot had been murdered by some unknown hands for the money for which he would have murdered me, and that probably we had both been shot into the river from the same dark place into the same dark tide, when the stream ran deep and strong. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.